Thank you, Anton. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a great day, and weather has cooperated too, so it's really been a pleasure to be here. And no, we have not solved all the problems in the field. You shouldn't say that, especially not to the funding agencies, please. This would be very bad. So, anyway, so as Anton said, over the past 10 years, 10 or maybe 12 years or so, we have actually been interested in trying to develop quantitative theoretical models to study essentially what I will call organization on many scales, both in living systems and actually also in synthetic systems. And this has led to this field, actually, the general field that I will want to tell you about today is something that we call active matter. And so I will start out by trying to tell you what active matter is and give you some examples. And I will focus today in particular on sort of dense active systems that can actually form solid and glassy states. And an example that I will use will indeed be living tissues. That is sort of distinct from the origin of the field, which actually spent a lot of time discussing more things like active fluid. I will tell you more about this in a minute. But in particular, I will focus on two examples. One is not a living system. It's a collection of so-called active colloids, which are systems that can actually condense for condensed states in the absence of any attractive interactions. And the other one is indeed living tissues and trying to understand the material properties of living tissues. So before, just in case I don't get to the end, I just wanted to show you some of the people who have actually done most of the work I'll talk about. This is my group, Syracuse University. We have a soft matter program. I'm lucky to have a number of colleagues, both theorists and experimentalists, with whom I collaborate quite closely. And the work I will talk about today, the work on colloids, was done mostly by two former postdocs, Silke Henkes and Yawen Fili, the current postdoc, David Llanes, and the current student, Adam Patch. And the work on cell was done in collaboration with my colleague, Lisa Manning, former postdoc, Max B., and the current student, Michael Tchaikovsky. And my student, Jinbo Yang, actually straddled both topics and contributed to both. He's now a postdoc at Northwestern University. And also, we collaborate with a number of experimentalists, and luckily, we get some funding from various places. So we are all familiar with various types of organization or large scales in nature and also in synthetic systems. That is, collections of entities that collectively do something very different from what the individual does. And this happens on many, many scales. An example here is a flock of birds, or it could be a school of fish. As you go down in scales, you could have many bacteria that get together to form colonies and so-called biofilms. Another example is actually cellular rearrangement in embryonic developments and in tissues. Or actually, even if you look inside the cell, this is a cell. The blue is the nucleus. The green and red are gels of long polymers that form something called the cytoskeleton, which is a structure that is indeed active in the sense that it's continuously remodeled by chemical reactions and serves sort of as the muscle and skeleton of the cell. So this kind of organization occurs on many different scales, and one of the ambitions of physicists, as usual, is to see what can they describe, whether they can describe some of this behavior in some common unified way. There are also examples from the non-living world, such as a swarm of bots, robots, tiny robots, as seen here, or these synthetic microswimmers or active colloids, and I will show you a specific example of one of these and tell you how at least one functions in a minute. So what do all these systems have in common to try to sort of define what I mean by active matter? Well, again, they are collections of entities that are self-propelling, bacteria, a bird, a fish, they're self-propelling. They transform chemical energy into some form of motion. They are interacting with each other, and collectively they organize in large-scale extended structures. So they are non-equilibrium systems, but they are different from more familiar non-equilibrium systems. We are used to systems that are driven out of equilibrium by, say, an electric field that acts in the same way on every particle, breaks the symmetry globally. Or a system that is driven out of equilibrium by forces applied at the boundaries. And in this case, you have energy that cascades from large scale to small scale, driving the system out of equilibrium. These active systems are actually have a drive that acts on each unit, on each particle. I will call these active particles. And so the symmetry is broken locally and in a sustained manner. They continuously produce entropy. And the fact that it's broken locally leads to the breaking of time reversal symmetry at the level of the microscopic dynamics. A movie run forward and backward for these systems that have this directed type of motion actually looks different. And energy does not cascade from large scale to small scale, but the opposite cascades from small scale to large scales, leading to this emergent behavior and organized structures that occurs in the presence of noise and in the absence of any leader. There is nobody telling the bird where to go or what to do, essentially. And if you want to read more after the talk, a group of us wrote a pretty long review a few years ago, published in Reviews of Modern Physics. But actually, you also have experts here at the University of Toronto, or the group of Ray Capral has done a lot of work on related systems. And I know Ray has actually, together with Rashmi Desai, has written a book on this. So you can also consult local experts. So now we are familiar with organization in equilibrium physics, in condensed matter physics, in fact, and with order-disorder transitions. And an example that I'm sure is familiar to everybody is the organization. So say we have a material where the atoms carry a spin and they interact with each other so that as you lower the temperature, they might go from a paramagnetic state where the spins are all pointing in different directions and there is zero magnetization to a ferromagnetic state where on average the spins are all pointing in the same direction. And we know how to describe this type of phase transitions in terms, say, of a free energy by minimizing, for instance, the free energy. So the question I want to ask today is now, can we actually think of these collective of self-propelling entities as a new type of active matter and ask some of the type of questions we are used to ask in condensed matter physics, such as what kind of states are possible, what are the macroscopic of these states, can we classify them? And also, what do we tune to change from one state to another? In equilibrium, we might tune the temperature, but here we do not really have the temperature. So what kind of effective parameters may actually replace play the role of a temperature in this system? Now, one issue is that these are non-equilibrium systems, so we cannot use a free energy. We don't know how to write down a free energy. And so we must describe them directly in terms of their dynamics. And that's what I will try to do. By the way, feel free to interrupt me with questions at any time, please. Just to give you a bit of historical perspective, as I was trying to explain to the great group of undergraduates that you have here, I will not talk about birth. However, the field was actually started essentially by Tomasz Wicek, a Hungarian physicist that was interested indeed in using statistical physics to describe actually bird flocking. And he developed a very simple model that we know now as the Wicek model to describe flocking as a phase transition by essentially using an analogy with ferromagnetism in the sense that he thought of the bird as a flying spin. The vector in this case represents the velocity. The speed is fixed, so if you are in two dimensions, most of my talk today will be in two dimensions. If you are in two dimensions, the only degree of freedom is one angle, the direction in which the bird flies. So now so the bird really is a point particle, has no size. You have a collection of this point particle, and there are rules that say that at every time step, I look at all my neighbors, I consider all the neighbors within a circle of a given radius, I calculate the mean direction in which my neighbors are going, and I align with that direction, and I move forward in the new direction, but with noise, I make mistakes. And you can write down equations to describe this model. The order parameter is the mean velocity of the birds. If the birds are all flying in random direction, the mean velocity is zero. If the birds are all flying on average in the same direction, the mean velocity is finite. And this system exhibits a phase transition as a function of density and noise strength. At high density and or low noise, you actually do get a flock. And here is a simulation of the model, not done by me. If I can find my... Where did we go? All right, sorry. I should have looked at the screen instead of my... Okay. It's a simulation of the model, not done by me, but just taken from YouTube. And this is a simulation of the V-check model, and you see that the birds form these flocks that move around. Of course, this has periodic boundary conditions, not quite the same for real flocks. But this system exhibits a phase transition, which is originally proposed to be believed to be a continuous phase transition, but actually has been recently shown to be a first-order phase transition with coexistence and hysteresis and complicated behavior. But the reason I mentioned the V-check model is the following. So the lesson, and I forgot one thing I wanted to say, that although we call this the V-check model, actually, the model is really originally due to Craig Reynolds, a computer scientist that works still today, I believe, for the animation industry, and actually developed the model quite a bit before V-check in 1987, and actually the model has been used in animation, and actually Craig Reynolds himself, I believe, used it for the first time to animate, to describe the flocking of bats in Batman Return, for instance. And he has actually even won Oscars for some of his work. But we still call it the V-check model. So the lesson you learn from the V-check model is that you can actually describe some of these complex organizations you see in nature from very simple models with minimal rules, with minimal local rules. And the V-check model was indeed a model of point particles. There are no actual physical interactions among the so-called birds. And actually, this model has inspired a lot of great work that has been applied to describe what I would call active fluids, not just bird flocking, but for instance, pattern formation in bacterial suspension, and also the organization of structures inside the cells, things like the cytoskeleton or the mitotic spindle, if you know what these things are, and if you don't, that's okay. But one of the things I became interested in is trying to ask whether I can actually get some similar physics out of models where the individual particles are still self-propelled, but the interactions are what I would like to call physical interactions. For instance, excluded volume interactions, steric repulsion, or hydrodynamic interactions mediated by the fluid through which these particles may move, or other ones. And in particular today, I actually want to tell you about some of the effects that arise when you take these self-propelled or active particles and they have a size, and you pack them in so that they become crowded, and you actually can get systems that are essentially active solids and actually active glasses. But let me give you first some examples. First of all, a fun example, again, that I will not actually talk about. These are, I will not try to model, although it has been modeled. These are emperor penguins in Antarctica. The movies were taken by German physicist Ben Fabry. And when it's in the Antarctica winter, the penguins huddle. They form these closely, densely packed, dense packs. And the interesting thing is up here, actually, because what the penguins are doing, they do very small movements, just a few centimeters on their feet. And by doing that, they keep packing themselves closer and closer together. But if you are a condensed matter physicist and you look at this image, what you see is that the result of the collective behavior are essentially phonons. And this is why we like to say that this is an example of active matter. Collective behavior of many interacting particles leads to you know, in physics, we like to describe things into collective modes, and you can see those here. So that's an example of a crowded active system. Another example, it's one of these active colloids I mentioned at the beginning. These are experiments by Jeremy Palacci a few years ago when he was working at NYU with Paul Chekin. And these are micron size, about 1.2. These are actually plastic beads, about 1.2 micron in diameter. They have embedded in it a piece of hematite. Hematite is a magnetic material that when immersed in hydrogen peroxide, and when you shine UV light on it, it leads to the catalysis of hydrogen peroxide. Now, the bead here, you can't quite tell, but the bead is actually inside the plastic. It doesn't actually stick out. So these are little spheres. So again, when I put them in hydrogen peroxide and I shine UV light, these will become active particles. Now, when they're not active, these are just colloids. They undergo Brownian motion. You will see them jiggling around. When there is no light, you will see just jiggling around a little bit like Brownian particles under the action of the collisions due to the fluid in which they are immersed. When the UV light goes on, they become active particles and they swim around, very similar to some bacteria, the way a bacteria would. So the first movie I will show you is a fairly low concentration. Okay, now, again, I am of these active colloids. And now there is no light. You see they're just jiggling. They're Brownian particles. But when the light is on, they become self-propelled particles. They swim. They are active colloids. At higher density, I guess I should have used the... They do something quite interesting. When the light is on, they spontaneously aggregate. They form these clusters. And this is really a non-equilibrium effect due to the self-propulsion, because as soon as the light is switched off, you will, as the movie will tell you, you will see that the cluster forms apart. So this is aggregation that is induced by the non-equilibrium self-propulsion of these active colloids. So that's another example of an active system on a very, very different scale and on of a very different variety. And the last example I want to show you is the one that actually I will try to describe a little bit more in detail, which has to do with cells. These are so-called epithelial cells. So this is a layer of densely packed cells. This is called, the cells are called confluent. It means they're densely packed. There are no gaps between cells. These are actually some type of breast cells from the lab of Giorgio Scita at the University of Milano. I had written this. I don't know what happened to it. So this is a movie. I will run it in a minute. On the left here, you will see that the cells are densely packed, and they're really jammed. They're kind of jiggling around a little bit, but this is essentially a glassy state. You can analyze it quantitatively and show that there's a property of a glassy system. Then what these researchers did is that they added to this jammed layer of cell, they actually added a protein called Rheb5a that sort of stimulates endocytosis and changes sort of the cell-cell interaction at the boundaries, and essentially melts the solid-like layer and turns into a liquid. So you can take tissues and perturb them in various, such as in this way, and essentially fluidify them. And one of the things I'm interested in describing is the idea of how you, so can you, again, this is an example of a liquid-solid transition in a living material, and I'd like to tell you about how we are trying to describe this kind of systems. Now, the idea that tissues are, you know, have some of the properties of solids and some of the properties of liquids is important in many real situations, and I just want to show you one more movie here. This is an embryo of a fruit fly, and all the dots you see are cells. And what I want to show you clearly during the development, I don't know why this is doing this, during the development of the embryo, clearly the cells have to move and flow like a fluid during the development to get to the right place. But once they get to the right place, they have to be able to support shear stresses, so in some sense they have to become more like a solid. And again, the tissue can tune these sort of liquid-solid transitions spontaneously, and we like to try to understand how this might happen, how physics might be able to describe some of this behavior. So the question I want to ask is that, can we develop some models to try to quantify these liquid, glassy, solid transitions in these kind of active systems, perhaps in a unified way for the colloids and for the cells? Now, before I do that, I want to just use two slides to give you a brief reminder of what we mean by glassy. So I'll be talking about sort of glassy solids, what we mean about how do we quantify glassy behavior in non-living matter. After all, a glassy material microscopically is as disordered as a liquid, so we don't actually have a structural order parameter. We cannot look at the structure of the atomic structure and say this is a glass. We have to look at the dynamics. So the image up here is actually a colloidal glass from the lab of Eric Quicks, and you see that there are all this jiggling around of the atoms. And if you actually image, this is a simulation, but you could do it in experiments, if you actually image the motions of the atomic rearrangements as you approach the glass transition from the fluid side, essentially you are in a supercooled fluid regime, you find some characteristic type of motions that are called, some characteristic type of swirling motions that are called dynamical heterogeneities. And this can be quantified and are known to be a characteristic property of glassy systems. Essentially, what it is that in these very dense systems, particles can only move if other particles get out of the way. And so the motions, the rearrangements, have to be collective and have to be of this type. So that's one feature that when we see these, we say, oh, this is a system that has glassy behavior. Another metric we use to quantify the transition to a glassy state, a very simple one, is the mean square displacement, which is plotted here as a function of time. Again, for an inert material, as you lower the temperature, and you go from the liquid state, where the mean square displacement a long time grows linearly with time, system is diffusive, to a regime where you see this flat behavior, the mean square displacement does not grow in time, the particles are locally trapped or caged, and sometimes they can escape their cage a very long time, and that's why the mean square displacement starts growing again. And systems that have this kind of behavior as you approach the solid state exhibit viscoelasticity. They behave like elastic systems a short time, and they behave like liquids a long time. Now, again, the simplest system that exhibits this kind of behavior is a collection of attractive particles or attractive colloids. And this has been studied extensively, and you can quantify, even though this is just a cartoon, you can quantify the behavior and organize the various states in a phase diagram. And attractive colloids can go from a liquid to a glassy or gemmed state when you increase the density, or when you decrease the temperature, or you increase the strength of the attractive interaction. And they can also be driven in and out of solid states by applying an external shear. You can shear the system and actually turn it into a fluid. Now, tissues show dynamical heterogeneities. This is, again, another sort of, these are called MDCK cells. It's also epithelial skin cells. And these are the local cell displacement imaged by particle image velocimetry in the lab of Dave Waits at Harvard. And you see these dynamical heterogeneities, these collective rearrangements, which are a signature of glass transition, and are indeed viscoelastic material. If you take an aggregate of cells, a ball of cells, and you squash it quickly on timescales of seconds, it springs back just like a rubber ball would. But on time scales of hours, two balls of cells can fuse together into a single droplet, much like liquid droplet would. So tissues are viscoelastic materials and exhibit glassy behavior. And this led the group of Jeff Redberger at Harvard to suggest that one useful way of organizing biological data of tissue, maybe through a phase diagram similar to the one of attractive colloids, but where the external shear is replaced by cell motility. So again, cell layers may become glassy or jammed as you increase the density, as you change the adhesive interaction between cells, and as you change cell motility. And so one of the things we have been trying to do is to see if you can describe this phase diagram quantitatively. And after this really long introduction, I want to tell you about how we try to do this. So we want to model, I think this is dead. We want to model dense active systems in some unified manner as collections of active particles. What I already highlighted the property of an active particle. So active particles are self-propelled. What are the key ingredients we want to build in the model? First of all, these are always systems that are moving through a fluid or on a substrate, and that dynamics is overdamped. So the equation of motion is not Newton's law, F equal ma, but rather F equals zero, where the F includes all forces, including the friction with the surrounding medium. They are self-propelled, and they exhibit what I will call persistent dynamics. That is, they travel ballistically in a straight line for a while, and their direction is then randomized either by rotational noise, as in the middle figure, which is an active colloid, by a sudden change of direction, as in E. coli, that spreads out its flagella and changes direction by a big angle, or by other mechanisms, as in the change of living cells. So these are all examples of self-propelled particles that I want to model. And they actually move at quite different speeds. They are on different scales, but I will try to describe them in this unified way. So if I just have one of these active particles, the simplest model I can make, and again, this is just in two dimensions, but I can do it in three dimensions, is my active particle is a disk. It has I say that it's self-propelled, so I attach to the disk a velocity vector, and this is my self-propulsion speed. The speed is fixed. The direction is described by a unit vector, and it can actually change due to rotational noise. The equation of motion is very simple. There is friction, and the friction is balanced by the self-propulsion, by the propulsive force. The direction of self-propulsion is noisy and decays exponentially with the rotational diffusion rate. This is a rate, and the inverse of dr is a rotational diffusion time that describes the persistence of the dynamics. A Brownian particle would just have, the equation would just be that the friction is balanced by thermal noise, and you could calculate the mean square displacement, would be diffusive a long time, with a diffusion coefficient, which is temperature divided by friction. My self-propelled particle, it actually also diffusive a long time, with a long time diffusion coefficient, which is just the square of what I call the persistence length, which is the self-propulsion speed divided by the rotational noise, times the rotational noise itself. So a long time, the behavior of these two is not very different. They're both diffusive. But it turns out when you put many of these self-propelled particles together, then that's when the surprises arise. So if I take many self-propelled particles and I assume that there are some simply repulsive interactions among the particles, so again, these are disks, I'm assuming a soft repulsion because we had in mind here modeling cells, and so the repulsion is just like a spring. If two particles overlap by some amount delta, they repel each other with a strength K, as if there was a spring between them. If they don't overlap, they don't interact at all. There is no attraction between the particles. Dynamics is overdamped, and now in addition to the propulsive force, I have these interactions, and the direction of self-propulsion is randomized by rotational noise. So the parameters here that are important are the density or Peking fraction, how much of the plane is covered by particles, And this time scale, 1/r, that is the persistence of the dynamics, for how long they travel ballistically before having their direction randomized by rotational noise. If I simulate this very simple equation of motion on a computer, what I find is that these particles can form a condensate, even though there are no attractive interactions. They actually phase separate into a very dense liquid surrounded by a native gas. And you can actually show, you can develop a continuum theory, essentially, and show that you can actually solve for the steady state of the system. And essentially, it's very simple to understand what's happening. When you're thinking about just diffusion, if you have a density in homogeneities, you know that they will diffuse away, and the steady state solution will be that the density is constant everywhere. That's what we all know from elementary physics. But in these systems, remember, they are self-propelled. On the other hand, when they crowd, there is actually an effective self-propulsion speed that when they crowd, they slow down. And so the effective self-propulsion speed goes down as the density goes up. And you can actually show that the steady state solution for the density is that the density is like 1/ the effective self-propulsion speed that is itself a function of density. And this leads to a feedback and an instability that drives this phase separation or this clustering. And actually, if you think about it, this is even more intuitive and more familiar than diffusion. When it's crowded, you slow down. It's just that it's not what we normally do in physics. It's a form of self-trapping. And let me show you a movie of this, as we call it, motility-induced phase separation, if I can get to it. I don't know why this is so difficult, because I can't see it on my screen. Aha, okay, I got it. These particles are polydispersed, and so here you have a very dense liquid, almost a glassy state, surrounded by a native gas. And of course, there has to be some surface tensions that holds this together, and that's actually one of the things we don't quite understand yet. We don't know how to quantify. So, but this motility-induced phase separation occurs without any attraction, just as a result of the self-propulsion. And so these very simple active particles that just have self-propulsion and repulsion can exhibit fluid states, phase-separated states, and at even higher density, they exhibit a glassy state with these dynamical heterogeneities. And you can quantify this in terms of the mean square displacement, that indeed eventually, as you increase the Peking fraction or the density, it becomes flat as the particles get trapped into a glass. In fact, you can actually be much more quantitative. You can actually show that at high density, repulsive active or self-propelled particles do behave to a large extent like attractive thermal passive colloids. And effectively, provided the persistence time is long enough, essentially because when they collide and the persistence time is long, they are stuck for a while, they can't turn around, and if they're stuck long enough that other particles will come in and accumulate, they will start the clustering, and that is a very poor man's way of saying that there is breaking of time reversal symmetry in this system. So we have a glassy state, as we had in our cell layer, and we can construct phase diagrams, but I don't want to go through the phase diagrams, because when am I supposed to end here? Don't tell me right now. Fine. Okay. So the phase diagram is very similar to that of a gas liquid critical point. Only this axis, instead of being temperature, is 1/ self-propulsion, or 1/ motility. And whether this is really a critical point in the same universality class is something that we haven't really been able to show yet. So see, there are still things we don't understand, but we think it might very well be. But the question I want to raise now is, so am I really trying to tell you that tissues, skin, cell sheets behave like 2D, two-dimensional attractive colloids? That seems a little bit, I hope there's no biologists in the room, because I wouldn't like that too much. Well, there is a problem here. Now, this is an image, again, of a two-dimensional tissue, a sheet of epithelial cells. So first of all, as you can see, this is what's called a confluent tissue. As you can see, the cells are closely packed. There are no gaps between cells. The cells are these things that look, that have shapes of kind of irregular polygons. So the packing fraction, the fraction of the plane covered by cells, is one. It's always one. There are no gaps between cells. Now, I just told you about a phase transition that occurs as a function of density and motility, if you want, or cell propulsion, but also as a function of density. So it looks, however, that packing fraction may not be a key parameter in this system, that there might be some other effective parameters that control, like in the movie I showed you before, I said they had this protein RebA, Reb5A, that drives the fluidification of the system. Well, that doesn't change the packing fraction. It does something else. So I need to identify some other effective parameter that might drive liquid-solid transitions in this kind of epithelial cell layer. And so I want to tell you about a somewhat different model we developed to describe this that, however, incorporates what I told you before. So again, the layer itself looks kind of like a foam, a packing of irregular polygons. And there is actually a very well-established model that people have been used to describe the equilibrium properties of two-dimensional tissues, known as the vertex model, where indeed you model the tissue as a covering of the plane with irregular polygons, and the degrees of freedom are the vertices of the polygons. Actually, the simplest model, the edges are just straight edges, and that's why the degrees of freedom are the vertices. This is why this is called the vertex model, and this is a model that has been developed a long time ago and has been studied extensively by many groups and has been used to, has had many successes. Then, so people assume that the parameters that you use to, so you say you make like a tessellation of the plane with irregular polygons, and then you describe the system in terms of the area and perimeter of each polygon or cell, and you write down an energy to describe this tissue that has essentially two terms. It has a term that says that each cell tries to adjust its area to a target area A naught. This physically describes, the cells are not really flat, they're 3D, but they're incompressible in 3D. And so they can actually adjust their area by adjusting their height. And we incorporate, you incorporate this 3D incompressibility in this sort of harmonic coupling for areas. Then we have a term here, linear in the perimeter of the cell. So this gamma is essentially a tension, a line tension. And I have a minus sign here, which means that if gamma is positive, cells prefer to make their perimeter large. And this gamma really is determined by the interplay of two pieces of physics. One is the cell-cell adhesion that tends to make the perimeter larger. And the other one is what's called cell contractility, coming from the cytoskeleton. Cells tend to contract. And that tends to make gamma smaller or even positive. And I put a minus sign here because I'm working in a regime where I want cell-cell adhesion to be more important than this contractility. And then I put a square term in the perimeter because generally this tension will depend on the perimeter, and if this is a minus sign, I need something to stabilize the system, so that's the next term in the expansion. I can close the square and rewrite this perimeter coupling also as the difference between the cell perimeter and the target perimeter, where this target perimeter will depend on this tension gamma, as well as in there are also two elastic constants here. And I have two parameters, really, in this energy. One is the ratio of the two elastic constants, and I will not change that. But the other is the ratio of the target perimeter to the square root of the target area. It's a dimensionless parameter that essentially describes the shape of the polygon. A circle will have the smallest value of that parameter, and a say, hexagon has a value about 3.7, a pentagon has a value about 3.8, and so on. The more anisotropic and elongated the cell gets, the polygon gets, the larger that parameter. Now, my colleague Lisa Manning had been studying, and many others have been studying this model as an equilibrium model, that is, finding the ground states of the system by minimizing the energy with respect to the position of the vertices of the polygon. And they generally do simulations where they allow cells to exchange neighbors through something called a T1 transition, by which you see this edge changes here, and here you have the two green cells that are neighbors, and you go to having the two red cells that become neighbors. And there is actually an energy barrier associated with this transition. And they computed the mean energy barriers of the transition and found that the mean energy barriers, the parameter R is the ratio of the elastic constant, the mean energy barriers actually vanish at a characteristic value of this shape parameter, which is actually very close of the value to the value of pentagons. And so if the energy barriers to cellular rearrangements vanish, you could say the system is a liquid. If the energy barrier to cellular rearrangements are large, this system is a solid. Although this is not really the kind of a definition that we would like. This is an equilibrium model, and cells are certainly not an equilibrium system. So what we decided to do is to put together the two models, essentially. My self-propelled particle model with this vertex model, and develop a model we call self-propelled Voronoi, where we describe cells through a Voronoi tessellation of the plane, that is a covering on the plane with irregular polygons. The degrees of freedom now are the center of the polygons, and each polygon has a motility or a self-propulsion assigned to it. The dynamics of the model is described by an equation of motion very much like the one I wrote down for the particles, where I have the velocity, I have the self-propulsion velocity or cell motility, and I have a force. But the force now is determined from this tissue energy. It's complicated because the tissue energy involves the area and the perimeter of these polygons, which are determined through a Voronoi construction, so I cannot write down a simple expression, but it's determined by this tissue energy. And then the direction of cell propulsion is randomized by rotational diffusion, just like in the self-propelled particle model. One interesting thing about this model is that the forces are not pairwise, because the Voronoi construction, the shape of a cell, does not just depend on the shape of the neighboring cells, but it goes further out to other neighbors. Now, if you simulate this model on a computer, and you calculate the mean square displacement as a function of time, you find that indeed it undergoes a glass-type transition. It goes from growing linearly a long time, as in a liquid, to becoming flat, as in a solid. But it does so not as a function of Peking fraction, because the Peking fraction here is always 1, but as a function of this shape parameter P0. Remember, the perimeter divided by the square root of the area. And large P0 is a liquid, small P0 is a solid. In fact, you can actually define an effective diffusion coefficient by taking the long time mean square displacement divided by t, plot that, and you see that it goes to 0 at a value of p0, which actually will depend on motility, as we'll see, but close here to 3.81. The cellular rearrangements near the transitions are collective. They show this kind of swirling motions that I call dynamical heterogeneities, and that you can actually quantify as you do in glasses. So then you can actually do this for many, many values of the motility V0 and construct a phase diagram where the vertical axis is the cell motility and the horizontal axis is the shape parameter, which, remember, depends on the tension and so is controlled by the interplay between cell-cell adhesion and cellular contractility. And you identify a line where the system goes from being a solid to being a fluid according to the dynamics. This is a dynamical order parameter, is the diffusion coefficient. In the solid, the cells are fairly compact and roundish, fairly regular, their trajectories, they're caged, their trajectories are localized. Occasionally one escapes the cage and moves out. In the liquid, the cells are more elongated and their trajectories are diffusive, and so they fill out the plane. I'll be done in 1-2 minutes. These are just movies where we actually tagged one or two of the cells and colored them different to highlight the fact that in the solid they're pretty much staying caged, while in the liquid they're actually moving around. Now, the one interesting thing is that you can actually also, so in glassy physics, we don't really have what we call a structural order parameter. There's something that is associated with the position of the atoms and their arrangements in space that allows you to identify the glass transition. But here, actually, we can identify a structural order parameter. If we calculate the mean or the median, actually, I think this is the mean. I wrote the median, but I think this is the mean. So we take each cell, we calculate the perimeter, and we calculate the square root of the area of each cell now. Now, this is different from the control parameter I had before. And we calculate the mean of that quantity, which I called here Q, and we equate that to the value 3.813, where the energy barrier vanishes in the equilibrium model. We get this line, which actually coincides very well with the line established on the basis of the vanishing of the diffusion coefficient. So what this says is that an experimentalist could go and look at the cell layer and do what's called a segmentation of analysis and calculate, this would be a lot of work, admittedly, and calculate the perimeter and the area of all the cells and calculate this quantity and identify a transition from liquid to solid state. Then they could actually compare this with mean square displacement from tracking of cells, which is easier actually to do than the segmentation, and see if indeed they get this kind of correspondence. And there has been some, we are actually working with experimentalists on doing precisely this, and the results, I don't have a result to really show, but the results are somewhat encouraging. So, this is another example of an active system that exhibits a solid-like transition, and actually we are, and the idea here is that we have identified two actually possible effective parameters that might be useful in understanding how cells are driven in and out of these glassy states. One is this shape parameter, and one is the motility of the cells. Another parameter in the model was the persistence time, and actually that provides a third axis to the phase diagram because that also can drive system. And actually I think we believe from work we are doing with the experimentalists that is that third parameter that is the one that is affected by this RAB5A that fluidified the system in the movies I showed you early on. But I'm supposed to finish, so let me try to summarize what I think are some key ideas. So first of all, I guess the main message I would like to leave you with is that there is a lot of new physics in self-propulsion. If you take self-propelled things and have them interact with each other, even in very simple way, just through repulsive interactions, you get some surprising effects. And an example is the fact that purely repulsive active particles spontaneously condense in dense liquids and solid states, and actually we have used these to describe both active assembly of colloids as well as bacteria aggregation. And the second thing is that we are actually making some progress in constructing a phase diagram for tissues where we have identified what I will call some effective parameters that provide a way of organizing the data, which are different from the one proposed by Jeff Fredberg, but they sort of, you know, one of these, for instance, the persistence time of the dynamics may actually bring together many biochemical process. So the idea is that you might have many biochemical processes in tissues and you might be able to organize that in terms of an effective parameter, which is the persistence of the dynamics or something like that. And we have proposed this shape anisotropy of the cells as a possible structure order parameter that seems to correlate with the dynamics of the cell layer. Now, I'd like to leave you with a speculation. There is something which we are actually working on with physicists working on the physics of cancer in Germany. There is something in biology called the epithelium-mesenchymal transition, which is associated, which is something that, for instance, is believed to occur when metastatic cells escape from tumors. In the tumor, the cells are non-motile and fairly compact and round. And when they escape from the tumor, and they become motile and generally more elongated. And so the idea we are trying to pursue is that perhaps in the tumor, you first have a transition, a solid fluid transition from the non-motile compact cells to elongated motile cells, and then these motile cells are able to overcome the barriers due to the stroma, the surrounding tissues, and escape from the tumor. And this could be one of the mechanisms that driving metastatic, it could be one way of describing metastatic escape. That's clearly still to be proven. It's really just a far-fetched speculation, but I thought I'll leave you with that. So thank you, and I hope there are some questions. Yes.
So the first question is, why are you studying the cell model layer as a collapse transition of water from liquid to solid? So if you count the cell-cell interaction, just like if you decouple the interaction, it will behave just like soft sphere, right? So did you get a similar
So if I am in a situation where the cells are not confluent, they're not covering the plane, then certainly the, and that was our original idea, actually, then certainly the density is an important parameter, and we started out by describing the cells as soft spheres or soft disks in two dimensions and looking at liquid-solid transitions in that case. But the reality is that often in experiments, people see this kind of liquid-solid transition in dense layers where, in situations where the packing fraction does not change, remains the same. The plane is covered by cells. And so we were looking for other effective parameters that may tune the transitions between the two. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but... actually, we have included cell divisions in these what we call cell-propelled Voronoi model now, as well as actually we have developed a way of handling. So this is a system with periodic boundary conditions, which is clearly not very realistic. We have actually now a way of including boundaries, as a matter of fact.
Right, all studies based on 2D, right?
Yes. So actually, I'm not pursuing this, but my colleague Lisa Manning is actually working on this, and she has developed a similar model for 3D and sees very similar things in three dimensions, where, of course, now the relevant parameter is now the ratio of the area to the, I guess, two-thirds root of the volume. Yeah, I get that right. Yes.
Oh.
So the cell can change their area, okay, and the reason we think they can cell, because in reality they can adjust their height, and so that's how they can change the area. So here, so the system has periodic boundary conditions, and the total area is fixed, okay, and we have no division, no cell division. Now, we have actually included cell divisions, and we have included systems that have open boundary conditions so they can grow, actually, as a matter of fact. And we have actually using this model to describe so-called wound healing assay, for instance, and collective cell migrations and things like that.
So,
Well, so actually, that's a good question. I mean, that's kind of I don't know how to give you an example right now, but that's exactly what our idea is, that we would like to understand. You know, generally in real experiments, people might perturb the system, perturbing chemically or adding some protein or removing something. And what we'd like to understand is, so like this RAB5A I showed you before, can the effect of the protein be described in terms of one of my parameters, which are indeed motility or the cell-cell adhesion or something like that? We're not quite there, but that's exactly our goal. Okay. I see. Yeah. So, yeah, actually, I'll tell you something. So, first of all, at the boundaries, the particles have this self-propulsion speed, okay? In the bulk of the cluster, there is no order. They're pointing in all directions, and the effective self-propulsion speed is going down. At the boundaries, they tend to point in, and that's why the boundary is there. So there is some kind of local polarization, a band of polarized particles pointing in at the boundaries, and that certainly contributes because motile particle exert what's called now a swim pressure just by the fact of being motile, and so there is that pressure pushing in. If you use equilibrium expression to calculate the surface tension, such as the difference between tangential and normal stresses, okay, that you can do it that way, you find a negative surface tension, which would say that the cluster shouldn't be there to begin with. Okay, so that's the puzzle. But it's clear that these particles pointing in, providing this additional swim pressure, is what's holding the cluster together. I haven't tried that. So actually, we are doing something like that. We're doing some things of that type, but we are not. I don't know exactly what happens. Yeah. Because they know what to do. is that there is an asymmetry? Imagine I have a wall. All right. Now remember, they do that provided. So these particles are moving ballistically, and their direction is randomized by rotational diffusion. So. The time scale over which they move in a straight line, say, I call persistence time. Okay? Now, that time has to be long, has to be the longest time in the problem, longer than the mean free time. Now, suppose there is a wall, and I hit the wall. Okay? In order to leave the wall, I'm self-propelled, so I have my nose against the wall. In order to leave the wall, I have to turn around. If other particles arrive before I have a chance of turning around, I'll be stuck. If I am at the wall, I have half probability of being pointing in or pointing out. I can, if I'm pointing out, I can leave. So there is an asymmetry between the flux in and the flux out, essentially. And that's, so it's very simple, ultimately, but that's what leads to this.
So usually if you go to metastasis problem and subdirectional movement.
Yes. So we have introduced, these polygons, cells, have this motility, but that's in random direction. Now, on the other hand, cells, we have introduced the possibility for cells to locally, so let me call the motility a directional polarization of the cell, right? We have introduced, we are looking at various interactions by which cells can locally align their polarization with neighboring cells, okay? And there you can actually get, you can get alignment. And in fact, what you can do is the following. If you prepare say, a cluster of what I would call liquid cells, because I am in a regime of parameter where they're supposed to be liquid, surrounded by solid cells, and I have this other polarization, I can have a regime of parameter in which the liquid cells sort of penetrate the solid cell by forming fingers. And so then I do get some kind of asymmetry like that.
Okay, well, let's thank you again.
Thank you.